This is David Duke, broadcasting to the world on Web Radio. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke International Live Web Radio broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of importance to Europeans and people of European descent, wherever they may live on the earth, and certainly important to all people who love truth and justice and freedom and the right to maintain their own heritage and their way of life. The principles that I believe in, I advocate not just for myself, but for any other people. I'm consistent. I'm not hypocritical, as are so many of the Jewish supremacists who dominate the American media, who preach equal rights for everyone else, but support an Israel, which is a Jewish supremacist state. A Jewish supremacist state. Let me make that very clear to all of you. Israel's an immigration policy that is only available for people of Jewish descent. There are a few people of Jewish conversion who come to Israel, and there's a few laborers who come who must in fact leave. They sign a contract to the effect that they will leave, and in fact many firms make them sign a contract that they won't have sex with or marry Israeli women. Now imagine if a company in America had their employees or anybody sign a contract, say if they brought in Mexicans or someone, and made a contract that these people would not have sex with or some sort of a marriage or a relationship with an American girl or a European-American girl. These are the kind of things that happen in Israel all the time. Israel has laws against Jews marrying non-Jews. It's simply not recognized. A marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew in Israel doesn't exist. It's against the law. And in fact, Israel has literally stopped Jews from marrying other Jews who didn't happen to have the genetic purity stamp, the Jewish genetic purity stamp. And we're talking about the Cohen class, which is kind of the priest class. It's a symbolic, historic elite of Jewry, kind of the SS of Jewry, the SS of Israel. And I've publicized, you can read on my website, davidduke.com, about the case where Mr. Cohen couldn't marry a Jewish girl who was fully Jewish by religion, but in her ancestry, she had some of that hated Gentile gene, and so the government would not allow the marriage. Not just the Jewish apparatus of religion, but the government wouldn't, because people tend to forget that Israel is indeed a theocratic state. That's right. It's not really a democracy by any sense of the term. It's certainly not a democracy when you consider that it controls millions of Palestinians who don't really vote and determine their destiny, while Israel militarily occupies them and submits and subjects them to all kinds of degradation. Of course, Israel right now is busy trying to cut off the funds for Hamas, the legally elected government of the Palestinians. They don't like Hamas because Hamas is a military-oriented organization for Palestinians, the same way that Israel is a very military-oriented organization for Jews. Israel was founded by terror. They literally terrorized and drove the Palestinians out of their homes. Is there anybody listening that doesn't know that? Is there anybody listening that has simply, you know, their mind blanked out when they came across the study of how Israel came to be? Does anybody know about the conflicts, the wars that existed, the massive Jewish immigration into Palestinian land, the fact that Palestinians own 95% of the land of Israel, until they were terrorized and forced out by the Jewish terrorist groups like the Irgun and other Hadassah, many other Jewish terrorist organizations. And then once they were terrorized out, and you know how they terrorized them out, ladies and gentlemen? They did some mass murder, such a Deir Yassin, where they literally ripped open the bellies of pregnant women and just mass murdered and did atrocities against men, women, and children in this small village. The International Red Cross has documented all of this, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not just making it up. It's true. And then the interesting thing is, not only did the Jewish radical extremists who founded Israel commit this kind of human horror, something that would certainly be equal to anything that they claim against the Nazis in terms of individual acts of terror. We often talk about the, or in the media, it's often talked about the what happened in Lodz, you know, when the National Socialists came in, or what happened to this group of Jews or that group of Jews. But what's happened to this, to these hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were dispossessed from their homes and who were forced out by terror and then not allowed back, and then the Israeli state declared their land, their property, their farms, their businesses vacant property and assumable by the Israeli state, and then the Israeli state then said that this land could only be held by Jews. Now, any other nation that tried to pull this kind of stuff, they would be called racist, right, and supremacist. But Israel can do it. How can Israel do it? How does Israel get this free pass, ladies and gentlemen? South Africa sure didn't. How does Israel do it? The only explanation, the only reasonable explanation is the fact that they have so much power in government, so much power in media. The media doesn't talk about it. The media sweeps it all under the rug. And the politicians know that if they dare to speak about it, that the concentrated economic, social, and political and media power of the Jewish supremacists, the Jewish extremists, will come down upon their head. Not only will they not get any more money, and by the way, the Wall Street Journal, in an article, said that about 50% of Republican contributions and about 75% of Democratic contributions came from Jewish sources. That's a lot from 2.5% of the population in the United States of America, isn't it? So, not only will they not get the money that they need for their campaign, but boy, if you become an enemy of theirs, if you dare to say maybe Israel shouldn't get so much of the American taxpayers' money, maybe we shouldn't be fighting this war in Iraq for Israel, maybe we shouldn't be sending Americans into battle to be maimed or killed or crippled or blinded or emasculated for Israel. Of course, the Iraq War was started and was begun simply as a massive lie. They couldn't tell Americans, well, you're going to go to war against Iraq and you have the possibility of thousands of Americans dying and you're going to spend tens of billions of dollars, if that, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, for Israel. No. We had to make American security because Saddam Hussein was a real threat to America. Well, as you all know, that's total garbage. We were the ones that broke international law by invading a country that had not even harmed us. You know, we did the same thing against Iraq that we prosecuted German National Socialists for in the Second World War, after the Second World War at Nuremberg, waging an aggressive war. What's it called? It's a preemptive war. A preemptive war is war. Anybody can say, well, I have to attack them before they attack me. That's a pretty good justification. Any nation can say that. And, of course, we said that. But the truth is, there was no preemption. There was no planned attack against the United States by Iraq. There was no threat of Iraq against the United States. And the truth is, Iraq used to be our friend. I've got lots of pictures of Donald Rumsfeld with Saddam Hussein, shaking hands, you know, having some good Arabic coffee. You know, but when Saddam was doing our bidding against Iran, which at that time was the big evil, and of course it's becoming the big evil again along with Syria, then, oh, Saddam is our good buddy. He's a great friend. We like him, and we're going to support him, help him militarily every other way to go against Iran. But that was really the balance of power. See, that wasn't the American interest either then. You understand? That was Israeli interest. Because at that time, if you remember, Israel was far more fearful of Iran than Iraq. It's a much bigger country, much more powerful militarily-wise, and a much stronger government, a government that was much more popular. The government of Iran is one popularly elected by the people of that country. And if we engage any sort of invasion of that country or attack against that country, bombing or whatever, I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, there will be hell to pay. God help us. Because there's millions of Iranians. In fact, there's hundreds of thousands already who've signed up for suicide squads against the United States. If the United States lays so much as one bomb, one bullet against Iran, these people will be flooding into to Baghdad, and they don't care about numbers. They will lose tens of thousands if they can take out thousands of Americans or hundreds of Americans. And any American anywhere in the Middle East or anywhere in the world, and there are millions of Americans all over the world, will be fair game, and there's no way the United States government can protect them. But why is Iran an enemy? Because Iran supports the Palestinians and is very anti-Israeli. Iran exposes the hypocrisy. You remember the cartoon scandal? That was something started by Fleming Rose, a person of Jewish descent, a radical Jewish neocon, a good friend of Daniel Pipes, one of the neocons in Washington. This is a fact. You can check it out for yourself. Well, this guy runs these cartoons. They knew it would get a reaction. They kept pushing for a reaction. He wanted a reaction. And then, of course, the West reacts and they react. And, you know, we've got all this this damage being done. And Israel just sits back and laughs about it, because the attention you see is now away from Tel Aviv and away from Israel and away from Ariel Sharon and away from that record of war criminality of that country. And we got all the Arabs more angry, you know, at the Danes or the Norwegians or the Germans or the Austrians or the Americans. They love it. They love it. And this is the kind of thing that they pursue. This is the thing that they do consistently. And yeah, I'm getting some call during the show, but I'm not gonna answer any phone calls till after the program's over. If you want to send me an email, you can do that very quickly and easily at info44@davidduke.com. That's info44@davidduke.com. Now today I also want to go into the David Irving situation in Austria, a very critical and important issue, ladies and gentlemen. Very vital issue, extremely vital issue, because it's one dealing with our freedom of speech and press and all the things that we hold dear when we talk about freedom. If we really believe in freedom, ladies and gentlemen, we've got to discuss this and we've got to deal with this issue. It's an incredible issue. David Irving is a gentleman that I know very, very well. I've been knowing him for years. We've had many hundreds of conversations, many hundreds of letters exchanged back and forth. We've consulted on many issues, and I must say, many times I've sat at his feet more like a student than a teacher. I was able to bring him a few documents, I think, which he used effectively, and a few ideas. But overall, I must say that he taught me a lot more than I taught him. When I was working in My Awakening, he at that time was living in Key West, Florida, at a mutual friend's apartment. And I went down there, and I stayed at that apartment, and we conferred for about 2 or 3 weeks, and I asked him a lot of ideas and asked for his advice as I was working on my book. Of course, I worked on my book for many years, but that 3 weeks was great. He read some of the chapters. He formed some opinions. He gave me a little bit of a critique on certain areas, and it was an invaluable bit of help. We also had a chance to play a little tennis when we could, do some swimming, and have many meals and many conversations about the world, and I got to know the man quite well. He's not always the easiest guy to live with, because, you know, he's a man that has got very strong opinions, and I guess I'm not either, to tell you the truth, because, you know, I've got my opinions, and I believe I'm open-minded, but anytime you have two strong personalities in the same room, there's a lot of potential for clash. But we got along great, and we had really great camaraderie, and, you know, we learned a lot. So I know a lot about the man, and I believe the man is very sincere. And the man, I believe there's not, the one thing I can tell you about David Irving is there's not a mean, cruel, angry, violent bone in his body. The man was anti-violence to a point of almost the, you know, extreme pacifism. And if you saw something on television where there was blood or violence, the man would just turn his face away, because he couldn't take it. He couldn't stand it. He just was revolted by man's inhumanity to man. Well, David Irving, of course, came to some conclusion. There's probably been no one who brought more original sources as to the history of the Second World War than David Irving has. He met with, in fact, nobody has ever documented the life and times of Adolf Hitler better than Irving. He contacted almost all the people who served with Hitler, all of his secretaries, his butler, his chauffeur, his adjutants, anyone who was still alive, anyone that was connected with him, from all the way back to his very earliest days of politics and even during the First World War in the trenches, to the present, or to the time of his death, I should say, in 1945. And David Irving had a pretty good sense. And David Irving, of course, came up with quite a different view of this man of history, of Germany, than did the popular view. But remember, the popular view of this whole period of time is very much framed and very much couched in the Jewish supremacist point of view. I mean, Israel came into an existence in great part because of the Holocaust, not just because of the fact that Jews were dislocated and they were then very viable settlers for a new country to dispossess of Palestinians, but literally because the propagation and the publicity and the pounding of the quote Holocaust into the consciousness of the Western world gave them a sympathy and gave them a tremendous opportunity in terms of getting material and financial and diplomatic support in trying to create the Jewish state. And in fact, many Jewish writers have said specifically that Israel would not even be a state except for the fact of the Holocaust. So at the end of the war, it was obvious that, and here's what I often say, in every war there's war propaganda, as you probably are quite aware. In war, there's the old saying that truth is the first casualty, and that is so true. On every side, the enemy is all black, and your side's all white. You're all good, and they're all evil. If you commit an atrocity, it's not talked about. If they commit an atrocity, then it's front page news, and it shows you the evil of the enemy. If you incinerate 100,000 women and children in Nagasaki, well, that's just part of the victory. It was necessary for, to save military lives on the ground, okay? If the Germans, would massacre 100,000 women and children, well, that's just those evil Nazi bastards, right? It's everything on this kind of issue is from a point of view, and it's tailored. It's subjective. It's absolutely subjective. And we've gotten a subjective history of the Second World War. Now, usually after wars, propaganda subsides to a great extent, obviously, because it's not needed anymore. The old enemies become friends, and people kind of say, well, we said this about you, but of course that really wasn't true. And they become friends, they just develop trade ties and economic ties and social ties and the rest of it, and they go on their merry way. Now, this is what happened exactly, in fact, after the First World War. After the First World War, as you probably know, during the First World War and before the First World War, it was said that Germany was totally responsible for that war. They were the guilty party for that war. They're responsible for the just aggression of Germany. After the war was over, and also all kinds of atrocities related to the steps of the Germans were bayoneting the babies of Belgium. That's a literature thing, isn't it? And they were even boiling these bayoneted babies to make nitrates for munitions. I mean, that was the story. That was printed in a lot of newspapers and publications around the world, right? And the Lusitania that was bombed, it didn't have any munitions. No, it was just a blatant attack on a commercial shipping concern, and blatant loss of life. Had nothing to do. There was no munitions. Of course, years later, after the war, we learned there were munitions aboard the ship, which were fair game, and it was really the responsibility and the lack of control and lack of really decency and human consideration that put these people, that this company put these people on the ship when they were shipping munitions, even secretly. There were munitions on board. And that made that ship fair game by the rules of war. So we can go on and on, yet that sinking had a great impact in terms of the entering of America into the war, in the First World War. But after the First World War, the propaganda, lessened, and it was revealed that the Germans weren't bayoneting babies, that there was a series of entangling alliances that led us into the First World War, that led these countries in, and no one country could really assume all the guilt of the war. Then, of course, we have a situation that comes about with the Second World War. And I was just in Europe a few days ago. I met with some people. I remember in one restaurant. In fact, it was a beer hall. We had some very, very good German beer and pretzels and the rest of it. And I shocked this one lady who was a writer, in fact, and she's an aspiring writer, well-versed, very intelligent. And she asked me, she said, well, you're controversial. What are some of your controversial views? I said, well, I can shock you about a lot of views. For instance, you know, why does Germany have the guilt of starting the Second World War? She said, well, of course, the Germans started the Second World War. My country started this war. This war was begun by my country. And so I asked some basic questions, and I said, you know, just from the knowledge that you already have, if I just give it to you in a different light, you can see the fact that maybe that's not a proper analysis. That's a Allied who won the war analysis of the conflict. As you know, almost all the conflicts of land and people before the Second World War were conflicts where Germany really had the better case. After the First World War, the Treaty of Versailles stripped, you know, Austria from the empire. People spoke German, considered themselves German. Even Hitler was born in Austria. We had the Sudetenland people. These were all Germans, you know, over 90% Germans who lived in this area. They were stripped from their own country, held in bondage by another country, politically completely in limbo. The people of the city of Danzig in Poland, you know, a city of over 1 million people, a city about the size of New Orleans. And yet these were German speakers. There was a German city, and yet they were being held by a foreign country over 20 years by a foreign country, 20 years by a foreign country without their political social rights. You know, these things occurred. And the Germans proceeded to get these back one by one by diplomacy. Then they got into a shooting battle, a shooting war, yes, with Poland. And at the same time they got involved in the conflict with Poland, Russia got involved on the other side. At that point, the Germans said, let's make peace. There's no reason. We'll go back to all we want is our pre-1914 borders. We don't want to control any other countries. You just want the German people who are German, who speak German, and want to be with Germany, who voted legally 99% to be with Germany, to be with their own country. And let's make peace. Let's not have this terrible internecine conflict of Europeans destroying one another, destroying our beautiful cities, destroying so many of our fine young men and women, both civilians and military, in this conflict. At that point, with the invasion of Poland, it was not a world war. It was basically a border war between Poland and Germany, and also between Poland and Russia. There were many peace feelers by the German side that say, okay, we're not trying to take any Polish land, we just want to go back to the borders of 1914, original German borders with our German people in our own country. That's all that we were fighting for, that's what we want, that's all. We're not trying to take any spoils of war. We're not trying to make a new Versailles Treaty against the Poles or anybody else. Well, at that point, it was a war between Germany and Poland, and as I said, between Russia and Poland. But guess what, ladies and gentlemen? England and France then declared war on Germany. And that's what really brought it to the scale of a world war, or a European continent-wide war. And they were the first ones to fire shots and to make military attacks against Germany. In fact, for a long time after they declared war, nothing happened. The Germans did not go attack them. The Germans did not go declare war on them. They declared war on Germany. They wanted to make a wider expanse, and they decided to make this European war. Now, you know, at the very least, you'd have to say, in terms of the creation of the First World War, that all the nations were guilty of that war. In fact, even America, but again, there's so much of history that people don't know about because it's so quiet. The National Archives of the United States reveal that President Roosevelt, all during the preceding months between the outbreak of conflict between Poland and Germany, he was making all these assurances to Poland that, well, if you don't give back this German city to the Germans and the German, you know, the Polish corridor and the rest of it, and I will, and the American people will support you militarily and every come to your aid, and we will support you to the hilt. And all this, of course, was all yap. It was not true. The American people, as you know, didn't even get into the war until later, after the attack on Pearl Harbor. The mood of the American people was 80-90%, probably closer to 90%, against entering the Second World War, entering this conflict in Europe. People saw it as insane. Charles Lindbergh, one of the greatest men of American history, was one of those individuals that spoke out forcefully and creatively and beautifully on the subject. And he said it so clear so many times. Lindbergh said, you know, it's not a certain political process we've got to preserve in Europe. It's the European race. If we preserve the European race, he said, political progress will follow. But if we lose our heritage, if we lose our race, then we will lose all. And of course, Europe is losing our heritage now. And I believe a lot of this is a result of the Second World War. a war which cost 64 million of some of the finest lives of the world. How many geniuses did we lose? How many scientific achievements did we lose? How many works of art did we lose? How many great novels, great works of literature? How much productivity did Europe use? How many millions of artworks were destroyed, and pieces of architecture destroyed, and famous and ancient manuscripts destroyed, and great works of just incalculable value to our people? And how much human suffering was elicited by that war? My God, we shouldn't have had that war. Peace should have been made. We should have found a way to make peace. It's true that Germany bears a responsibility for that war. Yes, it does. But so do we. So do all the countries that were involved. It wasn't just Germany starting the Second World War. You know, and if there was any justification in terms of that war, Poland was keeping the city of Danzig and the Polish corridor away from the will of those people. The people voted in plebiscites to go back to their own country. They were being held in bondage, almost like you could say slavery, kind of like the Egyptians holding the Israelites. And guess what? You know, the conflict broke out about it, and then the other, England and France, declared war. They were concerned about Germany becoming so powerful. They were jealous. They wanted a balance of power and so forth. And Germany had become such a tremendous economic and social might in Europe. It's just incredible. Germany became the center weight of Europe. And there was a lot of jealousy in England about that. And it was more than that, too, of course. A lot of the Jewish supremacists who hated the Germans for their own reasons because of the German policies toward Jews, they also used every bit of influence, money, media at their disposal to try to agitate for war. And they did agitate for war, both in the United States, both in Britain and France, all over the world. And they used whatever influence they had behind the scenes to do that, such as the Wilson administration, where you had many Jews, high-ranking Jews, and powerful Jews, like Ben-Ar Baruch is a perfect example, one of the biggest financiers in America, whispering in Wilson's ear and trying to get America into the conflict. So that's just some little bit of background in terms of the Second World War, just some of the aspects of what occurred. Now, David Irving, who's now facing 3 years in prison, he investigated these things. And one thing that started out his career, he got involved in the terrible human atrocity, the war crime. I mean, there's no other way to put it but to put it that way, that occurred in Dresden, Germany in February of 1945. The war, for all effective purposes, was over. The city was flooded with a million refugees fleeing from the Bolsheviks from the east. The war was absolutely. We got some more guests here coming up. I've got such a busy house here. The war was absolutely was won by the Allies. The city of Dresden was a magnificent city, famous for its China, the Dresden China, beautiful artworks. It had never been attacked because there was no real military value to the town. Well, using American and British bombers, they bombed this town with incendiaries, this old multi-story building town, and they created what they call a firestorm, and they killed upwards of 100,000 people, burned to death men, women, and children in their homes. Let me take a break for a second. I've got some helpers here at the office, and I'll be back with you in one moment. And hello, back again. So Irving did some investigations on Dresden. Before that time, he was a fantastic young scholar. Came from a very poor family. His father, though, was a military commander in the British Navy, I believe, during the first, the Second World War. And Irving, you know, came from a very poor family, but he did very, very well in school. And he didn't have the money to take advantage of some of the higher education that he wanted to. He went, in fact, to Germany, worked in the Ruhr steel mines, steel factories, not steel mines. There are no steel mines. But and he worked very, very hard, learned the language. And he began his investigations. And he came out with a book on the destruction of Dresden, in fact, a book by that title. And was very well received, and it was the first of 30 books on these subjects. And incalculable research. He did tremendous groundwork. He went and interviewed the individual players in almost all of these events, both in the Allied and the German side. He read the diaries and dug up the diaries of all these individual people and the minutes of their secretarial minutes, for instance, of Churchill. We can go on and on and on. And Irving, because he came from a working class, you know, family, he always believed in the underdog, and it chafed his sense of fairness. That, again, it's always victor's justice. You know, when you win the war, the other side becomes the epitome of evil. And he began to see that there was evil on both sides. And he began to see that the Germans actually were pretty respectable people, that they behaved in an honorable way for the most part. You know, that they did some things, they did some terrible things, no question. And these things happen in war, and there's no defense of that. And there's a situation where anyone should condemn any sort of human atrocity that takes place. But you see, you know, we had human atrocities on both sides. The Allies had a policy of bombing the cities of Germany, people, places where civilians were, and they carried this war to civilians. In fact, they launched this civilian part of this conflict. And then later, Irving, and it never was his main focus, he began to delve a little bit into some aspects of the Holocaust. Reluctantly, I think, at first, because he knew it was such a highly charged issue. I mean, the Holocaust is like a religion today. Anybody who dares to say anything in conflict with the original story, it's kind of like someone who's accused of heresy or blasphemy in the Bible. Like one... It's like one Protestant sect or one Catholic sect against another one. It's like if you deviate from one line of the Holy Writ, of the Holy Scripture, then you are not simply wrong. You are like a blasphemer. You're in league with the devil. You are, you know, you don't deserve any quarter. You deserve the Inquisition. You deserve the rack and tongs. You know, you deserve excommunication. You deserve exile. And perhaps you deserve imprisonment, maybe even death. I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about here. The Holocaust has become almost a religion, whether you agree with it or not. I travel in Europe a lot, and I speak in Europe, and I'm very careful. I never say, quote, there was no Holocaust, or the Holocaust didn't occur. I wouldn't say that. But I certainly have questions about aspects of the Holocaust, and maybe in some countries that's even now punishable. Bruno Gollnisch, a friend of mine, a member of the European Parliament, was suspended. Simply because he said that he didn't know enough about the Holocaust to know exactly what happened, and that historians should debate the issue. Simply for advocating free speech and debate, Bruno Gollnisch may face prison time in France. Now, not a man who denied the Holocaust or said something different. Just advocating free speech on an issue can lead to prison. You know, that's like back in the days, I don't even think in the days of the Inquisition, in the days of the trials of heretics and blasphemers and the rest of it. I don't think anybody, any monk who said, well, you know, they're, you know, these people deserve their say. You know, they may not be heretics. I mean, even the heretics deserved their say before the tribunal, before the court, to defend their position and to argue whether they were heretics or not and to argue their point of view. In Germany, you really can't even do that today. Ernst Zundel is facing trial right now. Ernst Zundel is facing trial. And what kind of trial is he facing, ladies and gentlemen? He's facing a trial where, in his defense, no one can get in there and testify as to what Ernst Zundel believes, because he believes is illegal to say. So how do you defend yourself in a court of law if you can't even he couldn't even have attorneys that he desired, because the attorneys supposedly hold beliefs that are illegal. Think about that for a second. I mean, we've gone to a crazy venue. I remember reading about the heretic trials, the blasphemous trials, Inquisition, in terms of Galileo. And Galileo, literally, he had a defense, and he had attorneys, and he had people that defended him. And in all these trials you did. But in Europe today, you can't even, in some courts, you can't even get in there to defend yourself, or you will be charged. If you get up there and say, Ernst Zundel is simply correct, he's just telling the truth, then you could be charged with Holocaust denial. But even the language is being framed. Holocaust denial, what is that? You know, they call Irving a Holocaust denier. What exactly does that mean? Well, as I told you, it's like the Holy Writ. If you deviate one line, I mean, just literally one sentence, one word from the so-called Orthodox view, and by the way, the Orthodox view is always kind of changing a little bit too, but it's done by their high priest, and so they can change it a bit. But if someone not in the high priest class, if they try to change it or question it, then you become a heretic, you become a hater, you become a bigot, you become a Holocaust denier. Irving never has denied, and neither have I or anyone else, we've never denied that there were atrocities that were committed against Jews in the Second World War, and that there were terrible killings and other aspects that took place against Jews during that conflict. Of course, one of the differences, we say that those kinds of atrocities took place against other people too. I mean, 11 million Germans were displaced. 9 to 11 million Germans were displaced at the end of the Second World War in the middle of winter, 45. Many millions died in that process. Millions of girls, women, mothers were raped, terrible atrocities, millions killed, billions and billions of dollars of property built up over the ages, farmhouses and farms and businesses that were created by families over many, many generations were completely taken away. We now have in part of what's Russia, it's called Kaliningrad, but it was Königsberg at one time. And the people who lived there were simply ethnically cleansed, wiped away. But that's never considered a war crime, never talked about as a war crime. And it's just typical of how we have a one-sided view of things. So Irving talked about some aspect of the Holocaust or some aspect of Auschwitz. And there's David Irving, now sentenced to 3 years in prison. 3 years in prison for having an historical opinion. And then people talk about freedom of speech and freedom of press and the rest of it. Now, I want to explain something, and I want to show you how you can make a big impact in the world and how you can bring people. People often ask me, well, it's a hopeless cause. We're blocked by freedom of speech. We can't really talk about the main issues. There's so many ways you can do it if you just act intelligently. Let me give you an example. You're on the Internet right now. You can go there if you want to right now. You can go to Google and do a news search. And just type in Irving and type in Guardian. Guardian is the name of a British paper. But there's many other papers, too, that do this kind of thing. The Guardian's got an article on freedom of speech. On freedom of speech. And you can read this article and read it fully. And you can also make comments at the end of the article. You can make comments. And there are many really good comments in this article. And in the process, if you're smart, you can do things to refer. Like you can refer to David Duke, you can refer to David Irving through our websites and say this or refutes that. You got to be smart in the way you do it. But literally hundreds of people have posted now, I think, on this thread on The Guardian from around the world. And these are a lot of intelligent people, certainly. Some of them not so intelligent. And thousands of people will read that thread, will read it. So take the opportunity. Take the opportunity to go to The Guardian and go to these other things, and you can go there. You can post considered comments. Always try in the course of it. Sometimes they will not take a website address. They will not take a website address. If you put davidduke.com in there or stormfront.org, that won't do you. They will simply block your thing. But you can mention David Duke, and you can say, well, David Duke, has got some good articles in this free speech. And in fact, they're more suppressive of free speech. And they're more monsters of oppression than David Duke ever was, because David Duke's always advocated freedom of speech for every point of view. He's always advocated freedom of speech for people around the world. Yet these people, you want David Irving and David Duke to be put in prison, and Gamma Rudolph and Ernst Zundel and the rest of these individuals. And you can say, you can see for yourself, go to his internet site and you can read for yourself his positions, and he is for freedom of speech. So these people are talking about how David Duke or David Irving is oppressive, and yet these individuals have always defended freedom of speech, yet these people who want to suppress them don't believe in freedom of speech. Who is oppressive? And these are the kind of ideas and the kind of approach you can use. It's effective. And you can literally reach thousands of people. Every day you can reach thousands of people. You can get your comments almost into any discussion. You can spend a couple hours doing this and you can help enlighten and make people, ask them really good questions, which could make people do some research. You got to find a way for them to get to our websites, davidduke.com, stormfront.org, the town hall section, also National Vanguard, and many other sites that are available out there. That's how you reach people. And then maybe once they read a really good and effective and hard-hitting article, then they can go from there and they can continue their education. And they continue to you know, kind of go from one point to the other until they begin to realize what's going on. I have a comment on my site, and also my email, and also on stormfront.org, the town hall section, which I want to make my comment on. This is from My Awakening Forum member. That's an interesting moniker he's using. He says, "Good afternoon, Dr. Duke and fellow Stormfronters. I'm just wondering Dr. Duke's opinion and thoughts on the subject of the United Arab Emirates company that will control some of the ports in the United States, New York, Philadelphia, etc. Just yesterday, Governor Rendell of Pennsylvania said that only 5% of the containers that come into the port of Philadelphia are checked 100%. In my opinion, this is terrible. I think it is best that people know more about the status of our port security here in the United States. It makes me wonder how safe we are. I also feel very bad about the outcome of David Irving's trial yesterday. Where is the freedom of speech that was supposed to exist in Europe? We can have hopes for the appeal, but we must prepare for the worst." Well, to my awakening, from my awakening, I just want to tell you that obviously we shouldn't have any foreign nations or foreign interests controlling our ports or any critical aspects of American industry or defense industry or telephone industry or communication industry or anything like that, period. I mean, it's just amazing. But it's interesting to me, the focus. You see, the Jewish supremacists don't like this fact either, because they're concerned about any sort of Arab influence in the United States. So they make this into a big deal, media-wise. But did you know that the Jewish government, a major Jewish firm, now does all the wiretapping for the federal government? That's right, the government of the United States does the wiretapping, like in the Converse Corporation, these other corporations. Read about it on my site. You know, can imagine a foreign country doing the criminal wiretapping for the United States government, a foreign nation, a nation which has attacked the United States of America in violent, criminal, extreme terrorist acts such as the Levant affair. And the nation of Israel just recently, you know, praised the terrorists who attacked the United States in the Levant affair. How about that, ladies and gentlemen? You know, how about the fact that we have insourcing and outsourcing of millions of American jobs, a disaster, a betrayal of America? Of course, I'm opposed to this. But let's get real. Let's start being concerned about some of the things that are even more important. How about the idea that these Jewish supremacists, these Jewish extremists, these Israel firsters are in the critical positions of our government? It's a fifth column who are orchestrating our American policy, not in the interest of our country, but in the interest of Israel. And they're leading thousands of Americans to their death or maiming or disfigurement. You know, that's a concern that I have. And these same people, by the way, are the ones that have opened our borders. I can also prove that, and I can show you that in my book, My Awakening and Jewish Supremacism. Ladies and gentlemen, we've gone way over time, almost an hour today. I've got a lot of work to do. I'm trying to catch up on a lot of things. I'm taking a little sabbatical from my teaching for a while to take care of some of the movement issues and things. And I've got a bunch of interviews to do and some other appearances to make around the country. And so I've got to get off the air for right now, but I will definitely be back with you tomorrow. I look forward to being with you. And go to The Guardian. Make your posts. Always lead people to one of our sites, Stormfront, David Duke. Mention the names clearly. Mention the fact that there are websites which counter the views. Use that as an argument. And you can help spread the word, and you can bring a lot of people to the truth about what's really going on in the world. You can help people connect my books to Jewish supremacism and My Awakening. I appreciate you being with me, and I certainly look forward to being with you tomorrow. And we're going to have a big week. There's a lot of things going on. And before I go, I just want to tell you and say, and I'll make this plea. I wish David Irving could hear me. David, I hope you remain strong. And I hope that you use your time and goal as I did. That you get back to your roots. You know, what really has motivated David Irving from his earliest days. That you get in touch with that, you get in touch with what's really important in your life, what's really important in the world, and that you use this time to rededicate yourself and steel yourself to these ideas. There's no compromise with these ideas, and there's no running away from them. That you will never win any fairness from them. I don't mind the fact that you pled guilty in a sense, trying to not go to jail for 10 years, but hopefully get a suspended sentence. It didn't happen. But I hope that you, and you have made it clear to most people, that you did it as that you were forced to, that they forced you to by the nature of the law. But you should, please don't back up. You know, be strong, be courageous, and I really believe that prison and this time in prison will simply make you stronger, that you'll get back to what your core beliefs and your core strengths. And that tends to be, you know, prison can do two things to a man. It can make them weaker. It can kind of destroy them, be the coffin, you know, the nail in their coffin of political activism and support, or can make them stronger. And I believe you're a very strong man. Obviously, look at the great strength that you've had in your work and your courage over the years. You've been attacked by your enemies. You have, you know, suffered tremendous reverses financially and economically because of your position. You were at one of the elite levels of the world in terms of storage. Your books are published in almost every nation in the world, including the United States, by major publishers. And this all went by the wayside because you dared to say a few things that they didn't like. And so you've suffered a lot, but you got to remember, and I think you will remember, who you are and how you got started in this thing. And I urge that, too, for a lot of the people listening to this program who are older like me and David Irving, that just remember how you felt when you were a young man and you first got involved in this movement. And there's so many people like that. And over the years, you get dismayed, you get discouraged, you get hurt by what's happened. There's so much slop thrown around by the Jewish supremacists, the Jewish extremists, that you tend to lose sight of the ideals that motivated you as a young man and that motivated really our cause and that give us the strength and the courage that we have. And you kind of become, sedate. You become defeatist. Well, shake off that, all of you, and sit in a nice quiet room and think about the things that inspired you as a young man and realize we're coming to the great and final battle for our heritage, a battle which I believe that we will someday win, but we can only win with courage and honor and incredible passion. And I want you to reach back into your heart and back to your past and your feelings you had as a young man or a younger person when you first discovered this truth, and use that to motivate yourself. And if you've done well in life and you've made money or you have positions of influence, use it for the cause. You know, you're going to, every one of us is going to die someday. We can't take it with us. You know, we all need to make real sacrifices now to bring this truth to our people, not only in our own communities and our own families, but around the world. And you all can do that. It doesn't take that much money to do it. And by the way, my books, Jewish Supremacism and My Awakening, were almost out of stock. I've got to do some reprinting. It takes many thousands of copies to reprint to get a decent price so I can sell at a decent price. I've always tried to keep my retail price on my books quite low, $30, $25. So the maximum number of people could read my books. But to do that, you've got to do many thousands of copies when you print. And unfortunately, and ladies and gentlemen, I think you probably realize this, I've sold many books around the world. We're gone into about 8 or 9 languages for one or both of my books. And, you know, if I just lived off the royalties, if I just had the royalties of my book, you know, and nothing else, I could live a very comfortable and a decent life. Go where I want to, live where I want to. You know, I wouldn't be a super rich man by any means, but I would be very comfortable and I wouldn't be plagued with all the dangers and all the problems I have about being a leader and speaking and traveling and working and writing every day and doing this radio program every day. So, but let me tell you, instead of getting the money from these books and putting it into my bank account or putting it, you know, into a better life for me, it's basically gone back into the movement because I've used it to propagate what we're doing. So, because of that fact, I have very little ability to finance the publishing of this book and to do the other things that I've got to do in terms of keeping my bills paid and everything. I need some support. We need to raise about $120,000. That's right, to get these books published and in large quantities. That's what it's going to cost. It's a lot of money. So I need to raise it and. I hope that those of you listening, some of you listening who have some bucks, you can help us out, because I think many of you listening know that my book, Jewish Supremacism and My Awakening, that these books either woke you up or certainly inspired you and motivated you after you were woken up. And I hope, and I think we all agree, and I hope that most people agree, I certainly believe this, that these books are the very best books for people coming to our cause new, to educating people to our cause, motivating people to the cause, giving them a deep understanding and a way that they can stand up for it. Well, thank you so much. I will be with you tomorrow, and until then, God bless you and take care.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.davidduke.com.